Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey friends, welcome to another edition of the Tennis and Bagels podcast. This is your host, Vanch, and it is my honor to be joined once again by tennis writer and Hall of Famer, Steve Flink. Steve, we do this after every major, and I'm always really excited for it, and this one is no different.
Yeah, it was a really compelling tournament, Vanch, and I always enjoy speaking about it with you because it's in depth and we go over all the crucial points, and you know the game well, so looking forward to this discussion.
Likewise, Steve. I think we can get right away started with the men's final that took place on Sunday. Obviously, number one versus number two. Historically, it's a big moment, obviously, in men's tennis with Alcaraz winning this and toppling Djokovic in the final. But I guess we could sort of break it down set by set. Maybe we could start with the first set. And I thought right away the first key point in the match was Djokovic saving the first break point at 30-40 with 127 mile per hour serve out. Yeah. I think that was the first huge moment. And then, of course, Alcaraz coming out a little bit nervous, obviously, but with the occasion, overhitting quite a bit on his forehand. But Djokovic was super solid and, wasn't making any errors, really, and couldn't have played the first five games any better, including...
Well, he's super solid, but also the returns were coming back so deep. Carlos it was a really stellar display on his part. And you're right, it made a difference, just as it did at the beginning of the center match in the semis, that Djokovic fighting, when you're down a break point or a couple of break points in the first game, it's a big deal to hold because it changes though. And he by getting the break on Carlos immediately for 2-love, and the next thing you know, he's at 5-love, you see what a difference it made. But yeah, it was an excellent first set from Djokovic. You're right that Carlos pressed a bit, went for too much off his forehand, trying to bang spectacular returns off that side and missing. And maybe he was tense, who knows, but he definitely was reacting to the occasion. But I still thought it was a bit more, the scales are tipped a bit more on Djokovic playing almost a letter perfect set the way he would have scripted it. And so I think it was more that than Carlos, but boy, I mean, at that stage, I don't go along with the notion of it. I was surprised actually when Jim Courier said after them, Courier did such a great job on the commentary, but he made a comment afterwards that it looked like it was going to be a rout after the first set. I didn't feel that. Oh, yeah. I felt Djokovic got just the start he wanted, and I knew it was inevitable that someone as competitive as Carlos and poised as he is, that he'd make a push in the second set, and the second set would become crucial. I didn't see it as a rout. Now, that's why I was surprised that Jim said that, because I never felt that way to me. It just felt like Djokovic gave himself a nice cushion, got through the first set without too much energy and exertion, played it on his terms, and put himself in a position to win this final and get his eighth title. So that's how I looked at it. But let's talk about the second set now.
Yeah, for sure. I agree with you on your previous point, because as soon as Alcaraz held for 1-5, I was thinking, I mean, there's no way the second set won't be at least competitive.
Right.
And he has every shot to win it. And I just thought someone as complete as Alcaraz, and just having gone through what he did at the French, that he was going to learn from that and just find his way in this match. But moving to the second set, obviously Alcaraz is up a break, and he has a game point for 3-love. And it's 2-love.
Yeah.
It's 2-love, 40-30. And then he misses a big forehand. And then he goes for one of those drop shot lob combos.
The big point, sorry to interrupt. Big point, big game, no doubt about it. If he holds for 3-love, it's harder. Although I'm not convinced that Novak might not have broken back later in the set anyway. But it would have made Carlos feel a lot better he would have kept the momentum going and would have put him in a better position to win that set. And but Djokovic, by getting it back immediately, was comfortable again and was feeling like, you know, this set could belong to him. And he had quite a positive reaction to the break back there. You saw it and kind of screamed out. It was almost a pleasant surprise to him that he could get it back immediately like that. But then the rest of the sets on serve. That's the interesting part to me, that they both did a good job of protecting their serves from that point on. And you could sense that there was an inevitability about a tiebreak, that we were going to get a tiebreak to settle that set. And of course,
no doubt. And just one more thing. In the 10th game, Djokovic came up with a spectacular forehand pass on game point, and then he hit that awesome backhand flick volley.
Yeah.
It was like a dink. That was a really, really big point to hold for 5-all, I thought.
It was. But I didn't feel like he was going to get broken. Like, he got pushed a little bit. I felt like he was going to hold. And
yeah.
Anyway, we get to the tiebreak. And obviously, you know, Novak has got 15 in a row at the majors, 3 in Australia, 6 in Paris, 6 here. Yeah. And they weren't as letter perfect as the tiebreaks in Roland Garros. He made some mistakes, but it still was very impressive. And it was the key to almost every round that he played, including 2 against Hurkacz, that the tiebreaks were really pivotal in those matches for him. And ironically, he had said, leading into the final bunch, that he felt he was very aware of this tiebreak record, and he thought his opponents were too. And undoubtedly, Carlos was. I think he was right, which was maybe one of the reasons why Novak coaxed a backhand down the line error from Carlos on the first point of that breaker, and then had 2 unreturnable first serves in a row, which, by the way, was not easy on this particular day. Carlos was started to get a lot of returns back in play. So for Novak to get 2, you could argue they were both service winners, but they certainly were unreturnables, and have that nice 3-zip cushion. I mean, you had to believe at that stage, you know, that 2-set-to-love lead was looming, and it was impossible to imagine from 3-love for me that he would lose that tiebreak. Then, of course, I'm sure you noticed, obviously, that drop shot. Now, I'm not quite sure why he tried it, because first of all, it wasn't well disguised. That was a chance to start pulling away. And, you know, Carlos had already played 2 good points by then on his own serve to make it 3-2. So there's Novak with a chance to go to 4-2, and he nets the down the line drop. I didn't think it was uncharacteristic to me, Vance, that he would try that shot at that moment when it wasn't really in the cards. And Carlos is so quick. And looking at it at the time and then seeing the replay, since Carlos was onto it, I think he would have gotten to it and done something good with it. It just was not the right play. Nonetheless, I like the way Novak just buckled down, won the next point. They were staying on serve. And, you know, Carlos is 4-3 and Novak, you know, it's swinging back and forth. They're each winning their service points. And suddenly then Djokovic, in a clutch display from 4-5, makes a nice low backhand pass to force Carlos into the backhand drop volley error, and then passes him nicely. Use one pass to set up the next one and passed him down the line off the backhand. And suddenly it's 6-5. And we all know that.
That was quite clutch because Carlos also hit a very nice forehand drop shot winner to go up 5-4.
So, yes, he did. And but then there was extra pressure on Novak, and he won those 2 points. And there he is. And I'm sitting there in the center court, and you're listening to the crowd, and they're excited. They're sensing this might be the breaker might be about to end.
Yeah.
And I thought Novak did a really terrific job to win. How should I put this? To make the first serve return off the back end nice and deep. Yeah. Then Carlos answered with a pretty deep back end of his own, but it was not hit hard. Mm-hmm. That's why I was so surprised that Novak then netted the two-hander cross court into the net tape. You could claim a little unlucky because it was definitely in the net tape, but normally he's going to give himself more margin than that. And he's so aware of the stakes, the consequences of the biggest points, and not making a mistake and waiting for his openings. And I've never seen a look on his face quite like that one after losing that point. He stood there for a long moment, looking down, absolutely amazed that he had done that.
Yeah.
So that was very surprising. And then after that bunch, to change ends and have this happen again, but except worse in a way, the back end down the line into the net on the six all point, because he could have gotten himself back in the driver's seat, perhaps if he wins that point on card, you know, he goes up 7-6, maybe now he can close it. You know, he'd be serving at 7-6 instead of 6-7, and maybe he ends it. But that was a terrible error for him. And then obviously, then there was the attempted serve and volley by Novak. And I frankly didn't think it was a terrible idea. It was a 118 wide. I would have thought it might have caught Carlos a bit off guard, and that Novak would give himself a forehand volley, first volley, and take control. But he had no play. It was a down. It was a outright winner from Carlos down the line with good margin, very good margin, well over the net, but well inside the baseline. Very well done from Carlos. But the point is, the preceding 2 points had been handed to him, and that was so un-Djokovic-like, especially in a breaker. So I honestly think, Vansh, I'm curious to get your thoughts. I just feel like that there was a clear hangover. Normally, I feel like Djokovic is very good at losing a tough set and then starting anew at the beginning of the next set and reasserting himself and just sort of putting the disappointment behind him. Like, I had the feeling that was about to happen in Roland Garros, as an example, when he played Carlos there. He'd won a 6-3 first set, that hard-fought second set, well played by both. Novak is down 5-3, back to 5-all, and has a break point and doesn't convert. Missed a surprising miss there, too. And then Carlos breaks in the next game, and it's one set all, and then we know what happened after that with the full body cramping. But my point is, I didn't feel like Novak going into that third was in disarray or in distress. I felt like he will never know, but it looked to me like he was just going to buckle down and get on with his business. But this time I thought he got, even before the marathon 27-minute 13 deuce game, when Novak served at 1-3 in that third set, he already, I thought, was that something was definitely off key. And he even said himself, Vansh, afterwards, and you don't hear him talk this way very often, I wasn't myself in that third set. I wasn't myself. I don't hear him say things like that very often. I think that's an admission that he was still really disconcerted and dismayed that he had let the tiebreak get away. And he knew the importance of letting the tiebreak get away, because if he goes to two sets to love, now he hasn't lost since the Meltzer match at the 2010 French Open from two sets up. It's almost impossible to do it against him. Tsitsipas at the 2020 French made a bid from two sets down and got it into a fifth, and then Novak ran away with the fifth. He's almost unbeatable from that position. And I think he knew it, and I think he was distressed. And yeah, he made that. There was sort of an effort, a prideful effort in that fifth game of the third set, the 27-minute game, to try to keep it to one break and keep his morale up. But then once he lost that game, those last couple of games, he only won a few points from 4-1 down. He lost his serve kind of meekly in the last game. It wasn't surprising to me because he just wasn't there. And then, of course, he took the bathroom break, tried to get and I thought did a nice job coming back, because he had immediately loved 30 on Carlos's serve, couldn't break him, and then held from 15-40. And then from that juncture, finally getting the break for 3-2 and getting an insurance break at the end of the set, I felt like he was playing some of his best tennis again, and he was finding a way to finish off points more effectively. And it was being played more on his terms, don't you think, in that fourth set, once he came back and sort of found his range again. And then in turn, had the feeling that Carlos was physically weary and mentally weary, that there was some drop off there. I can't fully explain it. I don't know if he was really asked too much about it. I didn't hear him asked. But during that stage, he definitely seemed to be declining, and Novak was really on the ascendancy. I thought he did a very good job. And then I would have thought, Vansh, that breaking again in the last game when Carlos threw in the two double faults, that was going to really help Novak, because he'd served first in the fifth, and it could well have helped him, because he held from break point down, clutch hold, and then had that break point for two love. And the point for two love was the second most important I'd argue was the second most important, because the tiebreak point is going to be for two sets to love, and he's going to put it out of reach. But in any case, it was the other standout moment and the other surprising one, in that he took it was a beautifully played point by Djokovic leading up to the last shot, because he opened up the court, hit a cross court backhand, set himself up for a perfect forehand approach. And then Carlos, all he really could do was to try that lob down the line. And he did keep it pretty near the forehand sideline. And I know, I don't know how you felt. I understood why Novak didn't take it as an overhead. It was a little tricky. It's windy. It's a little tricky. The overhead has always haunted him in some ways. And he'd rather be hitting an overhead on an inconsequential point and not that one. So I understood it. What surprised me was that he just didn't execute the swing volley better. And I guess part of it was explained by him afterwards, that he could see Carlos moving to the open court. So that's why he wanted to go down the line behind him. But still, it didn't have to be that great. It just had to be solid down the line. And with Carlos moving in the other direction, it was almost surely going to have him beat. Because I'll tell you what, Bunch, nobody talks about it, but at the 2021 French Open final against Tsitsipas, when Djokovic was finishing it off, match point, he came in. It was a similar kind of point, shorter kind of lob from Tsitsipas, and Novak decided to take that as a drive volley too, but he put it away, because I think his drive volley is normally pretty reliable. So that surprised me. I was more surprised that he had missed the drive volley than I was that he didn't take it as an overhead. And I know Jim Courier said, and most people felt that way. Most of them felt you had to hit an overhead on that point, even if you try to get some slice on it. Well, it's easy to question him on that, but I think he knew what he was doing. I just think he should have made the shot. And had he made the shot and gone to two love, I think that would have finally done it for him. I think it would have been such an enormous boost to be serving at two love with a chance to get to three love and all the momentum going his way. He broke it twice in the fourth set. That was the second most surprising point, that after that point in the tiebreak. What were your thoughts on the break point for two love?
So when I saw him moving backwards and I noticed how windy it was, and I saw how high that lob was from Carlos, and good defending by him, I thought, oh, this is going to be tricky. At first I thought, just leave it, because it's probably going to go out. But then I watched the replay back and I'm like, no. This would have probably hit the sideline. So my thought was either take it as a slice overhead in the open court, or hit the swing volley cross court and don't worry about trying to wrong foot Alcaraz, because I think he got himself in a bit of trouble here in this fifth set, trying to wrong foot him. As in the next game, on the approach shot that he hit, he hit it way too central, because he was trying to catch Alcaraz off guard and trying to wrong foot him.
He hit it. It was a low ball. He was digging out a low ball. I understand
off
that.
Off the slice.
Off the slice. But it was far too much topspin from Novak on the forehand approach. You could see it as soon as he came off his racket. Unlike the approach shot that he made off the forehand that should have set up the drive volley winner. That was a perfect approach. But anyway, yeah, you're right. Maybe I felt the same way about the cross court idea. Hmm. You're giving yourself much more margin, and you take a good swing at it, accelerated swing, get a decent angle cross court. You're almost surely not going to miss it. And most likely Carlos can't even run it down, because that's what he did against Tsitsipas off a shorter lob on that match point in the 2021 French. He went cross court and Stefano said, no chance. Now I know nobody's as quick as Carlos, but I believe that would have been the recipe. But it was just that kind of a day. Those moments, that and in the tiebreak, where Djokovic did things that one does not expect from him. And Carlos is going to make you pay for that more substantially than anybody else. And it was amazing to me, the turnaround after that, how well Carlos served and how well he played once he'd held on to make it one all. Now, that I thought that Djokovic, he's at 30 all in the next game when that return came down the middle, and it was not very deep, but Novak had trouble getting up to that ball. He didn't gauge it quite right, and he missed it pretty routine for him. That was a big miss to go down break point. Then we already talked about the break point itself, but I thought the 30 all It was not a point he should have lost, not an error he should have made. And he was a little unhappy about that one as well. It was just that kind of a day. He played well, for sure. But after that first set, was he ever at his zenith? I don't think so. I think because of the fluctuating fortunes and losing the one set lead and finding himself having to sort of desperately fight back from two sets to one down, he was nearly good enough to do it, but not quite. So where I give Carlos the most credit, Vance, is the remainder of that fifth set after he got out of the break point difficulty in the second game, because he was just so good on serve the rest of the way at protecting that one break from 2-1. Those last, the last four holds were very impressive to me, and particularly the 5-4 game, which I thought was very gracious of Djokovic in the presentation ceremony to give Carlos so much credit for how he served it out. But it was very impressive. Djokovic made a lot of returns. He got it to 30 all. And Carlos just would not stop coming at him, would not stop putting first serves in that last game. So I thought that was the shining moment for Alcaraz, in that he sort of took it into his own hands once he had the break in the fifth and said, you're not going to stop me now. If you are, you're going to have to come up with something absolutely extraordinary. So I was impressed with that. It was almost like he knew he had escaped from a very precarious corner there on the break point and not going down 2-love. And then from there, he seemed to get it. It was almost like his energy level just soared. All that sort of difficulty, whatever it was, physically, mentally, emotionally, that was going on in the fourth set was now gone. And Djokovic, in turn, was definitely jarred by not exploiting that opportunity. And he's continued to play well. He didn't lose his serve again. And he fought hard right to the last point. But I think that one was on top of the set point in the tiebreak in the second set. It was a lot to deal with, even for someone as mentally tough as Novak Djokovic, because it was like he'd been given himself a second chance and unable to exploit it.
Yeah, all that is great analysis. I will also add about the fifth set. I felt like another key game was at 3-2, because I feel like Djokovic had some chances to get back and force the break back. And something that really impressed me was at love 15, Alcaraz hits this 121-mile-per-hour second serve into the body.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a big one to come up with that at that moment. And then I also thought at 15:30, Djokovic missed the second serve. In fairness, it was 100-mile-per-hour second serve from Alcaraz. And I know Wimbledon calls it a forced error, but I actually think that's quite generous, because that's a return that you would expect Novak to make.
Oh, absolutely. No, he should have made it. He should have made it. That's true. That game, that was a small opening. Obviously, he didn't get it to break point. But if he wins that point, he's going to be a double break point. That was an important game, and I agree. It's not.
And also the next point at 30 all as well, because he hit this awesome return. It was a backhand inside out return, and he had Carlos defending on the forehand, and he just had this sitter type forehand in the middle of the court, and he just sprayed it wide.
Yeah. So yeah. No, that was a big game. I mean, Carlos was not giving anything away, but Novak could have taken it into his, could have potentially had the break back there. It's true. Obviously, that was a better opportunity than even the 5-4 game, which went to 30 all. That was a frustrating game for him. It was sort of that kind of day where just a few misses here and there that you wouldn't expect from him, pressing a bit, but it was severely unnerving to him that he didn't put himself up two sets. And then that made the entire rest of the match, it threw him off key, I would say. And he played his way back into form. But yeah, it's true, though, that potentially could have been a 3-all in the fifth. I agree with that.
Yeah, for sure. And then I was impressed with Alcaraz's, his serving to be in this kind of a final. He played the best serving set of the U.S. Open in that final set against Rude. And now he plays the best serving set here. And what impressed me is he hit three aces, and they all came on game points.
Because he hit
it at 3-2, and then he hit it at, I think, earlier on in the set, and then he went to hold for 5-3. And he had a second serve ace as well to hold for 5-3. Yeah. So I thought that was...
Very impressive game. Now, he was supreme. Extremely confident by then. It was almost like he made up his mind that this title was his. It was, he was surprisingly confident, because I keep looking back on the comments he made and how he played against Holger, playing Holger Rune. Now that was a Wimbledon quarterfinal, and he came out there nervous, and how he played in the third set against Medvedev. It was the only time he lost his serve. We did it twice from a breakup, and it didn't end up mattering, but he didn't close it as cleanly as he might have liked to. And I think he'd admit that that was also in my mind, nerves about being in the final and wanting to get to the final, et cetera. So to suddenly be up a break in the fifth set of his first Wimbledon final and not falter in any way and play one good service game after another when he could have been down a break was very impressive. That's where he played. That more than any other stage of the match, to me, that was where he played like a true champion.
Yeah, I was also just in general just impressed with how patient he got after the first set and how he was using his slice a lot more, trying to break Djokovic's contact point on the backhand to set himself up those aggressive forehands. And just he really trusted himself a lot more, I feel like, in the longer exchanges. And even on the forehand, he started to put a lot more topspin, play with a lot more margin in the wind, and allow Djokovic
a lot of margin
to err on the forehand several times. And Djokovic, I don't think, is very comfortable playing in the wind, especially with the wind behind his back.
Yeah, he wasn't. You're right. Spot on with all of that. And it did surprise me, too, given the way Carlos had started and going for returns, that he suddenly made up his mind. He'd use the slice back in very effectively. Return with some of those. The forehand, he just steered it down. Most of his returns were down the middle and deep enough to make Novak have to think about how he was going to construct the point from there. And the other thing about it, Bunch, was not just the slice, but the forehand returns, not much on them deliberately. And therefore, Novak was going to have to generate his own pace. And on a day when he was feeling a bit tight and uncomfortable in that wind and not liking it at his back, those are the worst circumstances to have. And that was very intelligent of Carlos to make that fundamental change in his returning strategy. And it was very effective. Obviously, only the one break in the fifth. I mean, Novak did a pretty good job of holding the last two sets. It was just that one break.
Yeah.
But Carlos was making him work hard, and it was a little awkward. Suppose you think of some of those first set service games when Novak could get some cheap points, and I felt like he could win more points outright off the server on the first shot, and that was not the case later on. And it was a major sweeping adjustment. I don't know whether Carlos had discussed that with Ferrero before the match, that he should think about doing that. I feel like in a lot of these cases, he's figuring it out for himself.
Yeah.
He's a good thinker on a tennis court. And I feel like that one, he just, as the match unfolded, he realized what he needed to do there. And he realized he had to try to get, and it was impressive because actually there were, Novak hit a lot of very good first serves that, you know, in the 124 to 127 range that I didn't think were going to come back. And they did.
Yeah.
And that's frustrating too. If you're in Djokovic's shoes, you'd like to have a few more free points than he was getting. And Carlos just wouldn't give it to him. So that was a very impressive turnaround in Carlos's strategic plan.
Yeah, and I feel like a lot of people are talking about that 3-1 game in the third set and the, you know, the 27 minutes and,
yeah,
you know, whatever it was, like 13 deuces.
Yeah, that was right. Know,
yeah, 32 points. I mean, Alcaraz made 29 of those 32 returns. And, you know, I would even argue that maybe Djokovic shouldn't even have been in that position because he was up 40-15 in that game. He had a sublime backhand volley to go up 40-15. Once he kind of got himself involved in that deuce exchange, he was never really able to, like, pull away from it because...
Well, partially because he missed a lot of those game points too. There, you know, some errant forehands. He should have closed it a lot sooner, but he battled hard. And I think at that
because
stage,
I had a feeling that if he had held there, I think Alcaraz would have felt the pressure in the next service game of not converting his chances. Because
I'm not so sure, Bonchu. I'm glad we have a mild disagreement here because we see most of these things the same. But on that one, I would say, no, I don't think so, because he still would have been up a break. It wouldn't have been earth-shattering to him to change over and not have the second break because he's still serving from a breakup. And I think he still would have felt. I mean, let's just say that it had gone the other way, 13 deuces, but Novak holds. he still would have felt, well, I really worked him hard in that last game. He was lucky to hold. I'm on him. So we'll never know. I just felt like from the very first game of that set, Novak started making some very uncharacteristic errors. He was sort of shrugging and putting his hands up, like, how do I gauge this wind, and hitting backhands in the bottom of the net.
Yeah. I think he was really annoyed also on the break point, because I know he went for a really good serve. It was like 125 down the tee, and it was called a lead. And then then he threw in his slowest second serve of the match. It was 83 miles per hour, by far the slowest one that he hit, and he just got really, really tense in that moment. And then he missed a backhand in the net, and
that had a lot to do with the wind. It really did. Yeah. The wind affected his toss. I'd say more than any one aspect for either player, the wind affected Djokovic's toss, and he would take longer than he. I didn't feel like the extra time he took ended up doing him any good. He had to try to use it, to try to gauge the wind and make sure he got the toss right. But he would take an extra long time and still miss the first serve after the extra time. He couldn't get in a rhythm. And, to win 62% of your first serve points, it's very revealing. That's an extremely low number for him.
Two aces the whole match. And one of them came in the first set, and one of them came in the first game of the third where he got broken.
And it's shocking. Because, you think of how he closed out those sets against Sinner, and he's serving two or three aces in a game. And here he has two in the match. So you got to wonder. Yeah, I mean, again, it was the conditions. It was surprising. In fairness, there were a fair number of unreturnables. And so, that's just as good as an ace in its own way. But he's such a good spot server. He's so precise. So it's the combination of him not unable to be as precise as usual, and Carlos, I guess, reading it pretty well and doing a great job of just getting returns back into play. So a combination of the two.
Yeah, and do you think Alcaraz facing so many big servers in this grass court season, the Berrettini, the Jarry, even the match in Queens against Brindernesh, which is where this all started, His ability to read so many of these serves, change his return strategy in between matches. I mean, he's breaking at a higher rate than anyone on the tour.
I agree. One second, Raj. Putting the light on. You know what? It's a good point. I would say this, though. When Carlos lost beat Novak on the in Madrid last year, in that third set tiebreak, I read some quotes from him later, not that day, but it was some interviews that were done with him shortly after that. And he said the thing that impressed him most about Djokovic was how hard it was to read that serve. He never knew where it was going. So I don't know whether he and his team looked at some film and tried to figure it out based on Djokovic matches that they were watching against others, what patterns. I don't know. I have to say, there were stages in the Sinner match where I was equally surprised that Novak, within that 125 range and seemingly pretty close to the lines, that some of those serves were coming back. I was a little shocked by that as well, because I just feel like when he's serving that precisely, that accurately, near the lines in decent speeds in the 123 to 127 range, that I don't expect them to be able to return it. But Carlos did a great job of that.
Yeah, for sure. No doubt. And then, I like you also totally thought that Alcaraz losing his serve at 3-5 in the fourth set was going to be trouble, because you don't want to be serving second in that fifth set. And at that point, when Djokovic had that overhead smash, he had all the momentum. He had won, the swing volley. He had already won six of the last seven games leading up to that point. So at that point, the match was reminding me a lot of the 2020 Australian Open final against Thiem, where, Thiem also had those two break points in the beginning of the fourth set. And Djokovic comes in and he saves those with serve and volleys on second serve.
No, that was great. That was very gutsy. And you're right. I mean, he was in real danger there. And that completely turned the match. He was down 2-1 and has those clutch holes, and then ends up playing a terrific fifth set in the end to win it. But those games you mentioned in the fourth were critical. Yeah, it is reminiscent in some ways. And that was a dangerous match. His team at pretty close to his best.
Yeah, for sure. But, he made Carlos serve it out, and he got five of the six returns back in play in the last game.
Yeah,
And Alcaraz hitting that huge serve at 30 all to get to the championship point and then not looking back, it really impressed me that he didn't feel any of those nerves at all in that last game.
You know what? He missed the drop shot on the first point, but that wasn't nerves. He just missed the drop shot. That can happen. And he comes right back with a forehand drop shot winner on the next point. Yeah. And then the point after that, Djokovic hit a pretty decent backhand cross-court pass, and Carlos was lunging and made the winning volley there. So, listen, he was really at his zenith at that stage. And you're right, Novak made him serve it up. But to get back to your original point and the one that I made earlier, obviously, that's where that second game becomes so big, because Novak can serve his way from 2-love to 3-love, and the match might be close to over. And instead, it bugged him enough that, maybe it contributed to the loss of that service game at 1-all. But so suddenly that's why he smashed his racket, I think. He goes to the changeover down 2-1, thinking he should be possibly up 3-love.
Yeah,
I honestly think that's what was weighing on his mind. He was so irked that not only did he fail to secure the break, but that then he immediately lost his own serve. It was a double whammy.
No doubt about it. But I also think Alcaraz deserves some credit for the next 2 points after the swing volley miss, because he still could have been broken. And, he lost his first serves on both those occasions. But then he comes up with these huge forehands, and then followed by another drop shot winner. And then, on the next point, he also has a second serve. And then he goes a huge down the line forehand for a winner. And he the way he was just in the zone in that moment to hit 18 winners in that fifth set.
Yeah. That's the thing. You give him an inch, he takes a mile. That's the thing. That's why that Novak had to win that point when he was in command and did not. And Carlos then took it up 2-3 notches. You're right. Played the rest of that game well. But that didn't have much to do to me with the next game. The next game was really, it was imperative for Novak at that stage to put it behind him and keep holding and get to 2-1, 3-2, 4-3, increase the scoreboard pressure with each and every hole, but he was unable to do it. And look, I don't know, in a strange way, I've been analyzing this match in my mind for the last two, three days.
Same.
And I think, Vance, that maybe there was some destiny there. There's something the way that Carlos found a way to win this match. Because we were talking about it earlier, and Novak has that 9.58 winning percentage after winning the first set in his career, which is the best of any player in the Open era. If you look at his Grand Slam finals, he lost twice to Stan in the 15 French and the 16 US after winning the first set. He lost once to Rafa in a French final in 14 after winning the first set. But those are rare occurrences as well. The combination of all that, you say to yourself, okay, that and the chance in the fifth, and in a strange way, was this meant to be? Because, Carlos, to beat Novak, it's one thing to beat him, but to beat him from the set down, to beat him when it looked like he was going to break at the start of the fifth, showed a lot. He showed a lot of character to not get discouraged and to compete as honorably as he did.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And in the trophy ceremony, he said, this is even Steven, and he referenced the 2019 Wimbledon final. And, I think he'll move past this because, he still came within one match of winning four majors in a row. He still almost, won the first three majors at 36 years of age, just, for the second year running in 3 years.
Yeah, you put your finger on something important, Vaj. There was a lot weighing on his mind beyond beating Carlos. It was the eighth Wimbledon title, if Novak can get it, to tie Federer. It was the third major in a row to therefore go to New York for the second time in 3 years, having won the first three legs of the Grand Slam, and perhaps this time learn from the experience of 2021 and win the Grand Slam. So there was all of that, and the number one ranking, there was so much weighing on his mind historically. Carlos didn't have any of those issues. For Carlos, it was like this.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
He knows that at 20, he's going to be in many more Wimbledon finals. He wanted to strike right then and there, and he did, but he didn't have the same kind of pressure. And he also knew that almost everybody was picking Novak to win the match. And yet, so that all worked in his favor. And he very wisely portrayed it that way himself after his semifinal by talking about, well, we all know how great Novak is, but I'm going to fight. But obviously, he took it to another level in his mind than just deciding he was going to fight. He made up his mind he was going to win. So it's extraordinary circumstance when you consider Novak's record after winning the first set. When you're talking about 41 losses, or, you know, you did a little research and you could argue that it was 39 matches. But regardless, that's somebody that's, after that many years, I mean, it's just so few defeats from ahead.
Yeah, and he never lost at Wimbledon also from a setup, or at least a completed match.
Right, a completed one, exactly. No, it's true. And you add up all that, and, you know, I don't think he was cocky after the first set, but he always likes his chances. And I still remember him doing a Zoom call. It was shown during the early stages of COVID when nobody was going anywhere. And the players were doing some things together and getting on, and the videos were being sent out. And I saw the one that he did with Stan Wawrinka. And he said to Stan that what really bothered him about those two losses to Stan was that he'd won the first set each time. So in his mind, even in best of five, he should not lose from a setup. So all those things are weighing in his mind, no doubt about it. And then to have the chance, he would have been better off, let's face it, he would have been better off if, go back to that third game when Carlos Carlos having a chance in the second set to be up 3-love, as you pointed out earlier, and he's 40-30 and he can't get there, and Novak immediately breaks back. If he had lost that set 6-3, obviously his mindset's totally different in the third, but to battle it practically 90 minutes and be in a tiebreaker and have a set point and lose it that way was the worst thing that could possibly happen to him.
Yeah. That was the same logic I had for the first set as well for Alcaraz. The fact that he lost 6-1 and then he didn't go the distance and lose at 7-5, 7-6, 6-4.
That's true.
That worked in his favor as well.
It did. Exactly. Because he puts it behind him and says, I'm just going to start anew. And he's smart enough to know that it doesn't matter whether you lose a set 6-1 or closer. It's still the same value. It's one set. So you're right. He was able to just say, I'm going to forget about that one and start over now, which he did. So all those things weigh in. A remarkable match in many ways, you know, and great for the game. And I certainly think that, I mean, you look back on recent times here, they met in the semis of the French. They met in the finals here. Who knows? They could have played in Australia, but Carlos wasn't there. They could have played at the U.S. Open last year, but Novak wasn't there. But they've dominated the whole recent major scene, if you think about it. Going back to Wimbledon last year, Novak wins the tournament. Carlos wins the Open. Then we go to Australia and Novak. Novak again in Paris, and now Carlos here. So they're setting something up. The framework is there.
Yeah.
And you hope, we all hope, I think, that we can get at least a few more, maybe a bunch more, in the at the U.S. Open later this year, through next year, and on into the following year. Because by the end of the following year, it could be that Novak is thinking about retiring. You know, he's 36 now, so maybe at 38 toward the end of that season. But until then, we could get some blockbuster matches between the two. Because I'm convinced that Novak, you remember so well yourself, Bonch, I'm sure, that in 2021, when Medvedev took the Grand Slam away from him by winning in straight sets at the U.S. Open, They played again indoors in Paris later that year. It was an excellent match. It was a really high quality match. And Novak made some adjustments and served and volleyed a lot in the deuce court, used that wide serve to open up the court. And he was just a different player than he'd been at the Open. And he beat Stanhill in three sets. And I think it was one of his most satisfying wins of the year to avenge the U.S. Open loss and get back at a major rival, not a personal grievance, just professional pride. And I think it's very similar now, where he's going to try to look at this match here and see where he might have gone wrong. And he's going to feel like he's overdue at the U.S. Open, where he's won only three titles out of nine finals. So I just think he's going to go there determined to win the title. Not unable to play it last year, had the incident where he hit the lineswoman, smacked that ball, and it hit a lineswoman. He got disqualified in 2020. So we're, and then Stan Wawrinka in 2019, Novak gets hurt, has to retire against Stan. He's had so many mishaps since he last won the title in 2018 that he's kind of overdue there. And I think he probably believes that. And then what could be more satisfying? And then from Carlos's side of the net, he wants to defend. He's determined to defend that U.S. Open crown and try to validate his status and try and underline what he wants. He'd like to underline his success and win the two biggest tournaments of all and try to beat Novak in both of them. So there would be so much riding on it. But I think Djokovic would have tremendous incentive to strike back in New York. And I want to see that rivalry. I really want to see it spiral now, don't you?
Yeah, no doubt. I want to see them play so much in the next 2 or 3 years because, I mean, this is, you know, we're not going to get this for a long time. You know, Max, there's a short 2 to 3 year window, basically. And, you know, if they can, you know, I'm hoping they can even meet in Cincinnati if Novak plays there, because I don't think Novak will play Canada and Cincinnati. I think he will just go for Cincinnati and the U.S. Open, whereas Carlos will try to play both. And so we're set up for like a really good finish. And, you know, who knows, maybe the year number one will come to the line again, although I suspect that with Alcaraz just playing a lot more and also just with this win, I think he's probably the favorite to finish the year number one for the second year in a row.
Yeah, clear favorite. Because what could happen is after the U.S. Open, briefly, if Djokovic won the Open, I mean, obviously Carlos is protecting 2,000 points there. Novak is going back, having not played there. It's all a bonus to him. So he could briefly get it back. But then Carlos was hurt at the end of the year and had the injury in Paris and didn't play in the UN Championship. So he's, and Novak is not going to chase that. That's not going to interest him.
Yeah,
it would have been nice for him to win Wimbledon and be in commanding position number one with all those points. But at this point, I don't think he's going to be that concerned with it. I think he's just after these majors now, and number one is a bonus. And might have liked the idea of 400 weeks, Vance, you know, 389, get up to 400. But I don't think it would be that. I mean, he's so many weeks ahead of Roger in career, most weeks at number one. And so I don't think he's that concerned with it. But Carlos, for him, it's important, I think, to sort of sustain his pace. And that would be something he'd be very proud of, to finish at his age, to still be 20 and have 2 year-end number ones in a row would be remarkable. And I think it's almost inevitable unless he gets hurt. Because as you said, he's going to play more.
He'll get some. Look at his win percentage this year. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Oh, it's
47-4 on the year. And I mean, three of those losses are, you know, he had physical issues in those matches. And just that one loss to Marozsán in Rome, you know, he was totally healthy all the way through, let's say. But like, six titles, and I mean, he's going to get a chance for so many more. I mean, he could be in double digits by the end of the year if...
Oh, easily. Easily. Yeah, he'll probably end the year with about 10. Yeah. No, his standard has been remarkable. And this is with some real... Where I give Carlos a lot of credit is this is with real disruption. I mean, he couldn't play Australia. He's still hurting then. He gets re-injured in this... He hurts himself. It lingers. He pulls out of Acapulco.
Right.
He goes and wins Indian Wells. He gets hurt again a little bit in Miami. Skip Monte Carlo. Keeps going from there. I mean, he did a good job of managing those idle periods and then coming back strong and still playing really well. And I think his only concern has got to be to make sure that he keeps, when he has to pull out of those tournaments as he did Monte Carlo, that he doesn't. Realizing he's got to be careful. He's got those leg injuries. He's susceptible to some of those injuries. And he doesn't want to have a serious one. Even at Queens, as you know, The trainer was out at Queens. He didn't, you know, it didn't end up being serious.
Finals, no.
But he even pulled out of a little exo in hurling, and the one that Djokovic played, as another precautionary move. So I think he and his team are realizing, you know, they're going to have to be careful about that. But unless something like that were to happen, he'll end the year number one.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I mean, he's defending what, 3,000 points. I think Djokovic is just under that. But regardless, we're just set for a really, really good finish to the end of the year, because I think these two players, I mean, I think you'll probably have to put Medvedev in there at number three on hard courts. But on every surface now, these are the two best players currently, and they've just separated themselves from the rest of the field, it seems like, because
they have.
I mean, it's a clear-cut top two.
It is. Now, look, we know that there's no doubt, as we and you and I were talking about this right before we started, no doubt that the Medvedev matchup versus Carlos has become a nightmare, because he talked a lot about how Indian Wells was so slow, the courts were so slow, he wasn't really able to hold his serve well. He honestly thought coming into this one that he played his best, he was going to give himself chances to win. I think he based some on the serve and some on the surface. Didn't work out that way at all. He was pretty much humiliated again. And yet he can give Novak some tough matches, but I still say Novak at his best beats Daniel at his best. And Novak just has to bear down hard and do some of that serving and volleying and mix things up. And he'll still beat him, I think, on the big occasions. I believe that I don't expect to see a repeat of 2021 US Open, but you're right. Daniel, just by virtue of his hard court expertise and the confidence that he has on hard courts in general, and the way he played early in the season and when he ran up with all those tournament wins, including Miami. So he'll get back into the mix, but the other two are the best. So potentially maybe we get a final in Cincinnati. Maybe we get one at the Open. I would hope that there'd be two or three more meetings before the end of the year is not asking for too much. They might even end up playing in the year-end championships in the final, be fun.
And also Novak is going for the seventh title there to, you know, break Federer's record there. And so I think he has plenty to be motivated about, also with the Olympics next year.
What's that?
Also with the Olympics next year in combination with trying to stop Alcaraz, basically.
Yeah. But you know, we've been talking about it. I know I've been talking about it, and I think you have too, and a lot of people have, since Carlos emerged in such a big way last year, never mind the year before. Obviously, he made his mark at the U.S. Open when he beat Tsitsipas and got to the quarters. But essentially, since he started making his run the spring of 2022 and playing, had that great run from, you know, the semis of Indian Wells to winning Miami to the great clay court campaign, all we've been hoping for was that this rival would, but they haven't been together enough since then. Yeah. Carlos wasn't quite ready at Wimbledon last year when he lost to Sinner. So that they could have met at Wimbledon last year too, if he had beaten Sinner. So that's all changed now. Now they are the clear one and two. And I think, frankly, that the two of them will enjoy the rivalry, to tell you the truth. I don't think there's going to be any personal animus. It's going to be the challenge of finding a way to move past each other. And the hard court matches would be fascinating. They really would. They're both so great on hard courts.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I have heard some takes from people say that, you know, Alcaraz winning this match might propel some of the other players in his cohort, or the, you know, let's say the generation above him, with their Tsitsipas, Medvedev, Rublev, etc., to believe that they can also beat Novak. But I just don't see it that way, because I feel Alcaraz is just so much more complete right now.
And yeah, he is.
The only thing I have to start monitoring, though, is you know, how clutch can Djokovic keep on remaining in these occasions? Because we also saw in Paris-Bercy, for example, where he was on that streak of having won a bunch of those finals in a row. And then he was uncharacteristically a bit unclutch against Runa in that match.
He was. He got tied against Runa. He should have won that match.
Yeah.
I don't think there's going to be any pattern there. No, but the whole notion that you just mentioned was something that Carlos talked about in his press conference. And that's a nice side of it, put it that way, but it doesn't follow to me at all, because they've got their own issues trying to beat Novak. They're not Carlos, as you say, they're not as complete as Carlos. They don't have the mindset. They don't have the gumption of Carlos. So I don't think it suddenly makes Tsitsipas think, oh, well, you know,
no,
now I can turn it around against him. No, I don't buy that at all. It's a totally different situation altogether. And I was actually surprised that Carlos said it, because deep down, I wonder whether he really believes it. I think he was trying to be gracious and he wanted to mean it. And it was very well intentioned. But I think if you pressed him more, he'd realize, yeah, they're different from him. I mean, look what happened at Wimbledon. I mean, Novak had knocked off Rublev, had knocked off Sinner. Are they going to suddenly turn around and watch Alcaraz beat Djokovic and say, ah, I can do it just like Carlos did it? I don't think, I just don't agree.
Yeah. And you can see it just how well, you know, I think there's just that perception, especially when it comes to Sinner, just because the matches against Alcaraz have been so good, so compelling, and that's where they bring out the best in each other. But I feel like Sinner has a lot of work to do against the rest of the field, and also shoring up a lot of his own weaknesses. I mean, the forehand still sprays a lot from, you know, he still has a lot of work to do in his transition game. The serve can still get better. Like, he's just behind Alcaraz in terms of, you know, technical developments and physical developments.
He is, but, and I totally agree, he can't keep suffering losses to so many different types of players. He took advantage of an excellent draw at Wimbledon, all power to him. He gets to his first major semi. Good effort. And I don't think he played badly against Novak. He wasn't rewarded with a set, but he played decently the first two sets and got the third one into a tiebreak, was up 3-1 and double faulted, and Novak wins it 7-4. But I think that Sinner, when you want to talk about matchups, I do think he matches up quite well against Carlos.
Yeah.
And he's one of the few that can kind of, he can unnerve, he can make Carlos nervous. Because he can go toe-to-toe from the baseline with him. He's got so much power. And that I find interesting. I want to see if it continues, but I have no reason to believe it won't. I mean, granted, the Carlos had the cramping when they played in Miami, but Sinner looked awfully good against him that night again, too. So that's another matchup that I want to see repeated in the coming months. I'd like to see a couple, two or three more at least between them to see how those turn out. Because I do believe that's where Sinner seems to be at his best, is against Carlos. Had the match point at the U.S. Open, you know, that could have changed history considerably if he'd converted that. But he's consistently played Carlos tough.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You know, and as you were saying that, I was just thinking back to the Medvedev-Alcaraz match. And I was just thinking, you know, because it was just so one-sided and because, you know, of that return position that Daniil has. And obviously, you know, we saw him try and move up and, you know, in the first game of the, or at 5-3 in the first set, he moved up and he just missed all those returns. But when we were watching him, when he was playing Eubanks, you know, he made that adjustment in the fourth set tiebreak and then in the fifth set as well. And I was just thinking to myself, imagine if Eubanks had gotten through that match somehow. I think that could have been a more interesting and perhaps a tougher matchup for Alcaraz in the semifinals.
No doubt about it. Absolutely no doubt about it. I mean, hard for me to see Eubanks winning three sets.
Yeah.
But not hard for me to see him winning one and maybe making it a relatively close four-set battle. And then the best-case scenario, even pushing it to five. I just don't think he would have won. But I agree that he would have made him uncomfortable. He makes everybody uncomfortable. He had those fine wins over Norrie and Tsitsipas that got him to the quarters and had Medvedev on the brink all the way to 2-1 up to 3-3 in the four-set breaker. So he was so close. I agree. I thought about that too, how much fun it would have been to watch it. Also, the fact that Eubanks is such a gentleman and such a exhilarating player to watch, respectful of his opponents, but coming after them full force with all that aggression and not allowing them to rally, by the way. You know, obviously keeping the points as short as he can and going for winners. And he's got his forehand is terrific. I'm not wild about his backhand, but I really love the forehand. And it's improving his volleying, and the serve can be devastatingly potent. So we missed out on something there in an odd way. I was hoping that Daniel was going to make it more competitive this time. Yeah. When he made the comments in the press conference, I was like, well, maybe he's right. And I thought to myself, well, if he has a really good serving day and keep this thing close. And for a while, up until the end of the first set, he was doing that. But as soon as he lost his serve near the end of the set, then I'm thinking it just looked to me like very quickly he gave up. He's one of the most irregular competitors I've seen. There's stages where you feel like he puts up the brick wall and he calms himself down and he makes you beat him. And he's actually quite mentally tough. But then there's other stages where I think mentally he caves. And I honestly thought this was one of those times. Did you feel that way about his performance with Carlos?
I did as well, because I thought he could have served better. And I also thought there were times where his second serve was getting picked apart very, very easily. But Alcaraz was basically playing a return plus one on his serve. And that was shocking, because he was just stepping in, you know, on most of the break points, hitting his backhand down the line and then coming to the net. And then he was really just toying with Daniel. And, you know, it was quite jarring to see the number three player in the world get pushed around like that. And now, in fairness, he did make the third set a lot more competitive. But I think that had a lot more to do with Carlos actually losing his focus and you know, allowing Medvedev to get back in the match.
75% Carlos losing his focus, I agree. Yeah. And Medvedev was encouraged, kind of mildly encouraged by that. I think he thought maybe he could keep it on serve, maybe get it into a tie break, whatever. But no, it was Carlos getting distracted. And so it's an enigma. When you look at the early season, when you look at Medvedev having that string of tournament wins, and what's he got, five titles now? Yeah. Medvedev in the majors has, you know, and he managed to get to the semis here, but he's been a disappointment in every major. And oddly, I'd say a disappointment here that it would end that way. Yes. That it would end with not a better performance where he's at least pushing Carlos and taking a set and making it close and giving himself some reason to believe that he could strike back against Carlos on the hard courts. Now, I think if they play at Cincinnati or the Open, I'll be shocked if it's not straight sets for Carlos.
Yeah. No doubt about that. I mean, I was also impressed, how well Tsitsipas actually managed to do in the grass in this tournament, particularly just because, you know, his form coming in was not that good, but I was impressed by the win against Murray from two sets to one down. And I felt like he had plenty of chances to win that match against Eubanks as well, but it didn't happen for him. But I feel like this was actually a pretty good tournament now that I think about it.
It was. Yeah. And let's face it, to cut him a bit of slack, as you know, the rain in the first week especially was wreaking havoc with the schedule. So Tsitsipas was getting the bad end of the deal there and having to come back day after day. You mentioned the Murray match, played over 2 days. And, you know, this kept happening to him, and he finally straightened himself out. I did think he was going to beat Eubanks. And it would have been fascinating, actually, to see him play Medvedev on grass. So he conceivably could have been in the semis. No way would he beat Carlos, although I think he would have given a better account of himself than Daniel did.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. In a strange way, fourth round was not so terrible.
Yeah, exactly. I feel like that as well. I mean, what are your thoughts on Rune in general on Holger? In this tournament, obviously he had that, you know, they had that tight battle. I'd been looking so forward to seeing a Rune and Alcaraz match because they hadn't played each other since Bercy, you know, of last year. And you know, I was expecting more out of that match. I was really thinking that you know, that could be a five-setter, or it could be a, you know, tight four-setter. And, you know, once Rune lost that first set, actually, strangely enough, he also served and volleyed on that set point. And, you know, Alcaraz came up with a nice pass there. I just feel like he ran out of gas, you know, in the third set especially. And we just didn't get that competitive match.
I was saying exactly what you did to several of my colleagues in the press room. I felt like an idiot after the match, but I said, look, Rune is not going to win this match, but this is going to be four. This may well, I actually think it will go five. And actually most of my colleagues agreed with me. And you're right. That was one of the letdown matches of the tournament, you know, once the tiebreak got away, and his attitude was not terribly, it was not the defiant Rune that we've seen, the same one that beat Novak indoors in Paris last year, that we've seen him when he really puts his mind to something and has that attitude. He was passive by his standards. And I don't think going forward we're going to see many matches. I think the next couple of times, though, it'll be revealing when he plays Carlos on the hard courts, hopefully that later this year. How does he do if they meet two or three more times? I expect much more out of him than that. He claimed he wasn't feeling well. He was a little vague about what was wrong. And I don't like it when guys lose in straight sets like that and try to make excuses. But maybe there was some truth to what he was saying. But that, to me, was disappointing. We already discussed Medvedev, but the Rune match was in some ways even more disappointing to me.
Yeah, for sure. And, you know, I feel like, you know, in some ways, you know, he's more willing to counterpunch and defend than Alcaraz is. And, you know, he's got that versatile defense, especially on the forehand. But I just don't feel like his forehand right now is an offensive enough weapon. in combination. Yeah, in combination with the serve. Like, I, you know, for example, when he was playing indoors and without the other outside elements, I felt like his forehand and his serve was doing, were doing so much damage, and he was basically playing first strike tennis along with defending. But now, I, it's been a good year for him, but and he's gotten to these quarterfinals, and that's a good effort. But, you know, he's got to be winning some of those earlier rounds more comfortably than he is, for sure.
He does. He does. And, you know, then there's just been certain, maybe certain moments and certain matches that have cost him. I think he thought he was going to win Rome. He was surprised about the match with Daniel there. He was just a little disappointed with that. You're right. It's been a good year, not quite as good as it might have been, but there's a lot left. Yeah. So we'll see where he goes from here. There's always that concern about his conditioning, but I was really expecting a sparkler when he played Carlos. And frankly, I think Carlos was too. I honestly think Carlos went into that match expecting to be pushed a lot. It was very, and why? I mean, my God, Alcaraz served beautifully, but to lose at one stage like 8 or 9 service games, a point a game. I mean, he was just breezing through his service games again. That also surprised me because I think Bruno returns well, and I didn't get that. I just didn't get it. But that was the match that just didn't come off the way we hoped it would.
No doubt about it. Yeah, I want to switch over a little bit to the women's side, and you know, talk about I want to give Vondrousova obviously her due. You know, she her run to the final was not bad at all. You know, she beat Pegula. She had that, you know, excellent comeback win. There had, you know, Pegula had a break point for 5-1.
Yeah, third set, and Pegula won the second set 6-2. So she was on like 10 out of 13 games. She was on a tear. She was about to close the match out with a flourish. And boy, I wonder how she felt after the final when she looked at that, what might have been for her.
Yeah, you know, and I thought the story was going to be Ons Jabeur and Elina Svitolina because they'd each knocked off 4 major champions on the way, particularly Jabeur. I mean, to knock off Andreescu from 1-3 down in the third and then play that excellent match against Kvitova. Granted, Kvitova didn't really show up, but the matches, particularly against Rybakina and Sabalenka, from a set down and to get herself back in this position and do all of that work and, you know, be up in both those sets and then just totally lose her way in the final like that. It was tough to watch. That was one of the hardest matches for me to watch because I wanted her to win. I was rooting for it.
You speak for all of us. It was well stated, Bunch. I mean, what I didn't get was, okay, she's 2 love up in the first set. Chances for 3 love, doesn't take advantage of it. It's 2 all. And then she goes to 4-2. I thought at that stage, okay, she's going to be fine. 16 out of 18 points from there are gone. Yeah. And then to come from a breakdown at the start of the second, there's 1 love, 40 love. And the next thing you know, she's up 3-1 with a second chance and wins one more game. Very disappointing effort. When you consider that it was her third major final, her second Wimbledon final in a row, and seemingly her best chance of the three to take a major title. And obviously she carries immense burdens just because by virtue of, you know, Tunisia and what she represents, what she means in that part of the world. I have a lot of sympathy, but it just surprised me. I thought, you know, she joked a little bit after the semi because she knew that Vondrousova had beaten her the last couple of times. But I really would have thought she would have found a way on the center court in those surroundings at this time to get it done. And now I worry a bit because you alluded to all those other wins. I mean, look, Sabalenka was completely outplaying her up until I thought. Completely. She was outplaying her, in fairness. Tight first set, 4-2 in the second. And Sabalenka had not lost her serve up to that stage. And Ons found a way out of that match. To her credit, it was a gutsy effort to win that match. But obviously, she's not going to beat most of these other top players easily. It has to be going her way. So I don't think we're going to see tons more Grand Slam finals with Jabeur. And I just hope that the next one or two that come along, it would just be very sad for someone of her stature and popularity and her versatility as a player to not win a major. I really hope she can get it done. But I unlike last year, I'd be surprised, Bunch, this time if she was back in the U.S. Open final as she was a year ago against Swiatek. I don't see it right now. Do you?
No, I really have my doubts as well because she's almost 29. And, you know, frankly, the only major where I really think it could seriously happen was here because, you know, I as well as she played at the French Open, I just don't really see it for her there. Swiatek is so dominant, and you know, and grass just suits her game perfectly. And I feel like at the US Open she will need some help, you know, from the draws and in the hard court events, because I just think she's a better natural surface player, and also the power players, like you mentioned, you know, they're maybe more likely to hit her off the court there. So it's really tough. Like, three major finals lost, almost 29, but you know, this was her chance. So
I think she does a lot of things really well, but I mean, again, for somebody of her attacking nature, she loses serve too much.
Yeah.
And the ground game is a bit limited. She can really volley. She's got wonderful finesse, great touch. But I don't know. She's got her work cut out for her with all those players. It's just not going to get any easier. And this could have just made her life so much easier if she would have collected the title now and been the Wimbledon champion. And it would have just made playing the rest of the year that much more comfortable and fun for her. Now, tough road ahead.
Yeah, and you know, she played all those power players, and maybe that was the, you know, to go from that to playing Vondrousova, who's very tricky in her own way, but she makes you generate all the pace. She makes you, you know, get the ball by her because she has such good racket skills, and her prowess defensively is very, you know, she's got a great defensive game along with some great versatility with drop shots of her own, and it was just it's a tricky matchup for her.
But I don't think you're right. I think she can defend, but it's not the way she really wants to be playing. It's very tricky package that she's got there. Yeah. And in terms of making, you know, fully exploiting her gifts. And to get back to your original comment, I couldn't have felt more like you did. It was just like sitting on a pins and needles, and when it ended, it was very deflating. And that's taking nothing away from Vondrousova. But I have to say, I mean, she's left-handed. She varies the pace. She varies the trajectory of her stroke. She earned the title. Having said that, I'd be very surprised if she won another major. I think she struck when the opportunity was there. I think she can go to the quarters and semis of some of these majors, but I don't see her. I think there's too much talent around her, too. So all power to her for exploiting this opening and taking it when it was there, but I don't see it being repeated.
Yeah, I just hope, you know, we see what she can fully do when she's healthy, because she also had those wrist surgeries, and she's obviously been in the finals of the French before, an Olympic silver medalist. But you know, hopefully we don't see a pocket of time where, you know, she just goes missing, and you know, we see more stability. Let's say kind of like Muchova and in the Roland Garros, getting to the Roland Garros final.
Right, right.
Yeah, there's just a lot of depth in Czech tennis, of course.
No, there is, absolutely. And listen, Vondrousova, she's very appealing. I love the way she handled, she wore her success well, and the crowd enjoyed her. And she's got some nice variety in her game and great lefty skills. But this was something that I unexpected, and she pulled it off. But I fear that she's going to go in. She's going to be a prime member of the one slam club.
Yeah, I have very much agreed with you there. But yeah, I mean, is there any other story from the women's side, from, you know, Swiatek playing against Svitolina? Obviously those matches for Svitolina against Azarenka and,
you know, Svitolina was to me, she was so much fun to watch in this tournament, and for all the obvious reasons and everything she's been through and the quest she was on, and then of course she came up really. She had even more of a problem with Vondrousova than Ons did. I her game just does not match up well there. But it was such a fine run until then. The Svitolina match against Azarenka was one of the best matches of the tournament. Great win for her there in that final set super tiebreak. So I love the run that she had, and she can't be that disappointed with the semifinals, and good for her. She certainly has made an impressive comeback, and I hope that she'll ride. I hope she will take advantage of what she did at Wimbledon to get to the penultimate round and now start making a habit out of it again, and maybe make a return to the top 10. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I would certainly welcome that, and love to see it. And obviously such a quick rise, you know, to come back from April and be already in the mix like this, and back to back majors, already won another title. So
right,
yeah, it's impressive stuff. But
she was sort of the, I'm trying to think of the right, she was the most beguiling player in that field. The crowds were loving her and they appreciated her attitude and they knew what she'd been through and the other players respect her. I think even Azarenka, as tense a match it was, she took the fact that there was no handshake in the right light, understood it and dealt with it. So Svitolina was a major, major player in quotes at this tournament.
No doubt about it. And, you know, it was a step forward also for Swiatek to get to the quarters and get a little bit better on grass. I felt like she could have closed that first set out against Svitolina. You know, she had chances in that one.
5-3, Vansh. That to me was the key to that match. I think she lost it in the first set. She managed to squeeze out the second, but if she was playing from a setup, it's probably a different match. But I still have great admiration for her. And I feel like, okay, her time will come. She'll improve on the grass, but I think she's coming back to the U.S. Open. She'll be back there in a good frame of mind with a reasonably good chance to defend the title.
Yeah, for sure. But just, you know, how was your experience as well, just being on the grounds and being there in the second, being there, you know, for these matches? Like, what were some highlights personally for you?
You know, I can't single anything out. We've talked about a lot of them there. Obviously the final, the men's final was the highlight of all. But no, it's just always such a pleasure to be there. I'm struck again as I watched. I felt it during the Djokovic-Hurkacz match. I felt it watching Carlos in there. But there's something about a center court crowd that surpasses anything I see or feel at the other majors. They can't quite measure up to it. Something about the sounds in that center court. And it's particularly true when the roof is closed, but it's not a great difference from when it's open either. That is just the premier theater in tennis. So I always just get so much. I mean, I go over to court one. I was over there watching Eubanks and Medvedev, and that's a very appealing court too, as well. But I just think that center court is the most appealing place in tennis, and I never tire of being there. And I love the way granted, the fans can sometimes be a little unfair. They're rough on Djokovic, but overall, they're very animated and they're very educated. So I felt like, once more, I felt lucky to be on those grounds, because it goes back to 1965 for me with my first visit there as I was 12 and about to turn 13, and my father took me out there. So it's a long, happy history that I have at that place. And this year didn't disappoint me one bit.
Steve, that's a fantastic way to close out this show, as you describe the Holy Grail of tennis being Wimbledon Center Court. This was such a pleasure, as all the major recaps are, and I can't wait to do another one of these after the U.S. Open.
Yeah, I look forward to it, Vansh. You know, we think a lot alike, and I always enjoy bouncing these observations off of you. And largely we agree. And yeah, the Open will be a really. I think we're going to have even more to talk about after the Open. I just sense we're in for something very special there, and I'm getting my hopes up already, very high for that Djokovic-Alcaraz collision.
Likewise, Steve. Thanks a lot for the compliment, and have a good one.
Thank you, Vansh.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.